Our story this morning is called 13 Moons on Turtle's Back, and it was written by Joseph Brukak and Jonathan London, and the beautiful illustrations are by Thomas Locker. And the dedication in the front with this lovely picture of the turtle is dedicated to all the children of Turtle Island, which is what a lot of indigenous people call our planet, our home, Turtle Island. Begins. Grandfather leaned over the long spruce log. The small boy stood close, waiting for the old man to notice him. Grandfather looked up, a small smile on his face. "Kwe Soyap," he said, "you do well at watching. Come closer, see now what I have done." Sozap reached up and touched the carved shape of turtle. "How many scales are on old turtle's back?" Grandfather said. "Kina, look." Sozap counted with care. 13, he answered. "Uh-huh," grandfather said. "There are always 13 on old turtle's back, and there are always 13 moons in each year. Many people don't know this. They don't know, as we Abenaki know, that each moon has its own name and every moon has its own stories. I learned those stories from my grandfather. Someday, grandson, if your memory is as sharp as your eyes, you'll be able to tell them to your grandchildren." "Grandfather," Sozap said, "do other native people have moons too?" The old man nodded. "Yes, grandson, they do." The second moon of the year is from the Potawatomi tradition. They call it Baby Bear Moon. Long ago, they say, a small child was lost in the snow. We thought she had frozen. But when spring came again, she was seen with a mother bear and her small cubs. She had slept all through the winter with them, and from then on, the bears were her family and her friends. When we walk by on our snowshoes, we will not bother a bear or her babies. Instead, we think how those small bears are like our children. We let them dream together. The third moon from the Anishinaabe tradition. Sugar maple moon. Long ago, maple syrup dripped thick from the trees all year round. You just had to break a twig and lie down beneath the tree with an open mouth. But the people got lazy, and when our creator, Gitche Manitou, sent his helper, Manobozho, to visit, he found their village deserted and all the people asleep under the maple trees. So he poured much water into all the maples so that now the people would have to wake up, make fires, and boil down the sap to make syrup. They would have to work hard for that maple sap would flow just this one time of year, the time we now call the maple sugar moon. The seventh moon from the Pomo tradition, the moon when acorns appear. When the world was new, it was covered with water until Earth Elder, the creator, reached down to the mud below and placed it onto Turtle's back. Earth Elder shaped the sun and the stars, then sat for a moment, thinking of what was most needed, what would help the humans still to come. That was when Earth Elder made the first tree, a great oak with 12 branches arching over the land. Then sitting down beneath it, the sun shining bright, Earth Elder thought of food for the people, and acorns began to form. So it is each year when the sun shines brightest, these first acorns come and our Pomo people gather this moon's coming harvest. 10th moon from the Cherokee tradition. Right about now, moon of falling leaves. Long ago, the trees were told they must stay awake 7 days and 7 nights, but only the cedar and pine and the spruce stayed awake until the 7th night. The reward they were given was to always be green, while all the other trees must shed their leaves. So each autumn, the leaves of the sleeping trees fall. They cover the floor of our woodlands with colors as bright as the flowers that come in the spring. The leaves return the strength of one more year's growth to the earth. This journey the leaves are taking is part of a great circle which holds us all close to the earth. The 12th moon from the Lakota Sioux, moon when wolves run together. Long ago, an old wolf came to that time when his life on earth could last no longer. "My people," he said, "you can follow my footsteps when the time comes to you to join me in the sky land." Then he left the earth, climbing higher and higher, each place he stepped, the sky filled with stars. Shunk Manitou Tonka, we call the wolves, the powerful spirits who look like dogs. When they climb the hills to lift their heads and sing towards the road of stars, their songs grow stronger as they join their voices. So in this moon, we climb the hills, lift our eyes toward the wolf trail, and remember that our lives and songs are stronger when we are together. And finally, the 13th moon from the Abenakis, big moon. The elders say our land was shaped by Ozihozo, the changer, who formed himself out of the dust and fell from Creator's hands after making the world. He pushed against the earth to rise. The great mountains rose up on either side when the water flowed into the place where he stood and made Lake Champlain, the lake we call Petonkpagok, the waters between. When Ozihozo's travels on this earth were done, he came back to rest by this lake once again, making the circle complete. So it is our own people of the dawn place one final moon at the end of each cycle. We call it Kichi Kizos, big moon. Its name is the last of our circles of seasons. 13 moons on old turtle's back. And here ends the story. And so now it's time to, in your heart, listen to these words. Good morning. I may have missed your good because a plane, because a truck, because a gun, because a cop, because a government, because a people suffering, because too many people suffering, because war, because famine, because some mornings it is so hard to rise, to wake, to be a self. There is a pause here. There is a deliberate cessation. I want a cessation to the noise in my head, to the ache in the collective heart of the world. When I was young, this seemed possible. When I was young, I hoped that spring would be eternal. I want to write about butterflies, about cracked edges of tree bark pressing like a holy mother into palms. I want to write about the joy of children's laughter, about birth, about the arc of your smile. This you reading, listening to this. I want for you joy. I want your mornings good and your evenings good, all the late nights and sunrises and afternoons and moments pressed against the ticking glass of your life. good. But life is both joy and sorrow. We can't know one without the other. We can't stop the world. We can't stop the noise. We can't stop the ache in the collective heart of the world. But we can breathe. We can breathe, paying attention to that little catch between the in-breath and the out-breath. Breathing in, there it is. Breathing out. There's the pause, the space, that even if it's just for a moment, can break our hearts wide open in the freedom of the space it provides. So breathe. Breathe for yourself. Breathe for each other. Let us breathe in when others cannot, when we can do nothing else. Let us open our hearts and embrace our friends, anyone willing to meet us, even those we think will never move in our direction. Let us hold each other in this moment, in that broken, open place, for this blink of human existence. Blessed be.
It's the custom of this church to share our offering plate. And this week, the plate will be shared with the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. The UU College for Social Justice is a program of the UUSC, and their mission is to inspire and sustain effective and spiritually grounded activism for justice. The UUSCJ has compiled several resources to help non-Native people learn to work in solidarity with First Nations people towards a new and more just future. This is particularly urgent within the context of climate change and our own yearning to become solid, effective allies to frontline communities as we all confront this global challenge. UUSC's innovative approaches and measurable impact in promoting economic justice, bolstering environmental justice and protecting rights are at risk. And they are grounded in the belief that all people have inherent power, dignity, and rights. If you'd like your check to be allocated to your pledge only, write pledge in the memo line. And if you want your check to be allocated to the plate, for all of your generous gifts to the community, your time, your talents, and your treasures, we are truly grateful. Thank you.
This morning's reading comes from an amazing book that I highly recommend called The Indigenous People's History of the United States, written by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and published by Beacon Press. Under the crust of that portion of the earth called the United States of America, from California to the Gulf Stream waters, are interred the bones, villages, fields, and sacred objects of American Indians. They cry out for their stories to be heard through their descendants, who carry the memories of how the country was founded and how it came to be as it is today. What historian David Chang has written about the land that has become Oklahoma applies to the whole United States. Quote, nation, race, and class converged in land, end quote. Everything in U.S. history is about the land, who oversaw and cultivated it, fished its waters, maintained its wildlife, who invaded and stole it, how it became a commodity, quote, real estate, broken into pieces to be bought and sold on the market. U.S. policies and actions related to indigenous peoples, though often termed racist or discriminatory, are rarely depicted as what they are. Classic cases of imperialism and a particular form of colonialism, settler colonialism. As anthropologist Patrick Wolfe writes, the question of genocide is never far from discussions of settler colonialism. Land is life, or at least land is necessary for life, end quote. The history of the United States is a history of settler colonialism. The founding of a state based on the ideology of white supremacy, the widespread practice of African slavery, and a policy of genocide and land theft. Here ends the reading. And we hope to share with you a song that was written by Buffy St. Marie. Some of you may remember her. She's still around. And so we'll see. Nope. No. We won't be having that. So you have to look it up online. It's called We Are Circling. You'll have it in your order of service. You can go home and listen to it on YouTube. So we'll move right into our message then. I feel compelled to begin this morning by stating the obvious, that I am a white woman. In 2017, speaking to you about the lived experiences of indigenous people. This is not my story. It would be much better told by someone who owns it. At the same time, lifting up the history of indigenous people in this country is something I can do and we can do as allies. I can use my power and my privilege as a white person and a minister to name the truth at the heart of the matter. And so here we are once again on the eve of Columbus Day. My colleague Jason Cook writes, "The Columbus of childhood, the hardy adventurer who discovered the new world, a plucky sailor who greeted the Indians with a smile and a vision of new cities and the future, that Columbus is gone. never was. On the edge of Columbus Day, we sleep no more. We have heard those from history cry, "This is not our story." This discovery was no discovery. It was a conquering of peoples, of civilizations already here. So I don't know about you, but the Columbus of my childhood was the Columbus who discovered America. How many of you thought that when you were growing up, right? Boy, did I get it wrong. But I can understand how I got that impression. There are lots of ways that that myth has been perpetuated in the collective American psyche. As Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz points out, Columbia, the poetic Latinate name used in reference to the United States from its founding throughout the 19th century, was based on the name of Christopher Columbus. The 1798 hymn, "Hail Columbia," was the early national anthem and is now used whenever the vice president, still, when the vice president of the United States makes a public appearance. And Columbus Day, as we all know, is still a federal holiday, despite Columbus never having set foot on the continent claimed by the United States. So it's no wonder I was confused. But if Christopher Columbus didn't discover America, how did he become such an American icon? This is one of the things that I particularly appreciate about Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book. I want to know now, I want to know even more, how did his name become a synonym for the United States? And maybe after just beginning to read this book, perhaps I'm wondering and thinking that it has less to do with where he landed than why he was out there sailing around in the first place. So Columbus was really commissioned to bring wealth back to Spain, right? Basically, he was searching for gold, as were most of his contemporaries. But the church provided the moral authority necessary to take land and resources from the people already living there. The religion gave European Christians the moral superiority, a worldview that allowed them to dehumanize indigenous people so that they could just take what they wanted. Along with Balboa, Ponce de Leon, Cortez, and Magellan, Columbus founded a system of world colonization, a way of being in the world. And Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz suggests that from U.S. independence onward, colonial settlers saw themselves as part of this world system of colonization. So Columbus embodies a culture of conquest, a culture that we've come to revere as a nation. We celebrate a holiday dedicated to it that predates U.S. history. And we all know this because we all studied world history, and I don't know about you, but I just didn't put all these pieces together. It's a practice that Europeans honed in North Africa and the Middle East during the Crusades and in the Inquisition, claiming land and killing or subjugating the people already living there in the name of religion, all the while concentrating wealth and power for the hands of very few, namely the church and the landed aristocracy. The right to take and use the land for purposes of people in power is embedded, part of the very fiber of the dominant culture of the United States of America. So, I'm starting to learn and believe that this is probably the legacy of Columbus Day. It's not really one I want to continue or support. And so the story continues, actually. We all know that there was a lot of support for the water protectors protecting the river, the water, and trying to prevent the Dakota Access Pipeline from going under the Missouri River at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation last year about this time. The pipeline carrying fracked oil from the massive Bakken oil field was initially supposed to go under the Missouri River near the town of Bismarck to the north. When residents protested, the pipeline was rerouted to go under the river on reservation land. At Standing Rock, the number of protesters grew from 200 to 2,000, including First Nations people from all over the United States. On November 3rd, 500 ministers answered the call to come to North Dakota to join them. 50 of those ministers were Unitarian Universalists. And we know how events unfolded last fall as winter set in and conditions got worse. The North Dakota state law enforcement used their power to close those camps and basically shut down those protests. But in a ray of hope, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers initially halted construction of the pipeline to prepare an environmental impact statement. And on that emotional roller coaster that has become our government, President Trump immediately in January ordered the Corps to expedite the study. And in February, the Corps granted an easement allowing the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross under the Missouri River at Lake Oki, north of the Standing Rock Reservation. And still, the resistance continues. And in just a few minutes, Linda's going to share and give us an update on what is happening and has happened since then. And there is a lot going on still that we can support. And the first step is to know and learn about that. But first, I recently discovered that there is a very powerful and strong connection between contemporary events at Standing Rock and the history of the Standing Rock Reservation that I really wasn't aware of. It's not surprising that Standing Rock would be the place where indigenous people from all over the country would come to take a stand for the land and for the water, for their way of life and the very source of life. It's been the site of resistance for indigenous people for over 100 years. How many of you realize that? It's the place where the great Lakota Sioux holy man, Tatanka Yotanka, Sitting Bull, surrendered to the U.S. Army in 1883, and where he was killed by Indian police in 1890. And so I'd like to share a little bit about the story and what led up to that day, because I really didn't know much about it either, and I do think it's a really powerful connection that we all should learn more about. The Standing Rock Sioux are part of what was known as the Great Sioux Nation. Historically, they were nomadic people living in teepees, following the buffalo across the plains, until 1868, when they were forced onto the land between the Missouri River and what is now the state line of South Dakota in the west in what is called the Fort Laramie Treaty. The reservation included, at that time, the Black Hills, considered to be sacred land, Paha Sapa, the heart of everything that is in the Lakota tradition. The Lakota literally consider themselves to be descendants of the stars or star people. We heard a little bit about that in the moon story about the wolf walking the star trail into heaven this morning in our story. There are several natural features in the Black Hills that correspond to particular constellations, making them extremely important sites in the Lakota cosmology. And then a few years later, in 1874, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer led the 7th Cavalry on an exploratory mission into the Black Hills, in direct opposition of the treaty, violation of the treaty. And guess what? They were looking for gold. Just like Columbus, they were looking for gold. When they did find gold, it started a gold rush in the area, and the U.S. government tried to convince Lakota to sell or at least to lease the land. And as you can imagine, the Lakota refused to do that. And skirmishes, violent skirmishes broke out between the Lakota and the U.S. Army. In 1875, Sitting Bull refused to obey an order from the U.S. government to bring his people to the Sioux Reservation, and that's when the Battle of Little Bighorn, also known as Custer's Last Stand, ensued, and Lakota actually had a massive victory, massive losses in Custer's 7th Cavalry. And Sitting Bull knew that he and his followers were in trouble, so they fled to Canada, where they lived for 4 years, to what is now Saskatchewan. And this encroachment on Lakota territory continued during that time. There was an agreement, and I use the term quite loosely, in 1877, in which the U.S. government basically took the Black Hills from the Sioux Nation, and some believe it was in retaliation for the victory at Little Bighorn, and a punishment to the Lakota Sioux. Meanwhile, Sitting Bull and his people were starving to death up in Canada. It was terribly harsh winters. They weren't used to the way of life up there, so Sitting Bull brought his people back and surrendered to U.S. forces in 1883, and he was assigned to the Standing Rock Reservation, where he went to live in a cabin on the Grand River. He still was a very, very powerful holy man there, and the government really feared that he would incite an uprising or resistance among the people there. At the same time, the U.S. government, this was about 1890 now, it broke the agreement, further encroaching on the Sioux Reservation by breaking the territory up into 5 smaller territories and basically saying that the Sioux had to assimilate and to adopt white customs and renounce their religion and their practices. And so they gave each family about 320 acres to farm. And their children were forcibly removed to boarding schools where they were taught English, Christianity, and American cultural practices. You can imagine, farming in the Dakotas is not all that easy, especially if you don't have any experience with it. And so once again, the people found themselves on the verge of starvation. They could not take care of themselves with the resources that they had been provided, which were fewer and fewer as the years went by. And out of desperation, a ritual dance evolved called the Ghost Dance, which was really an apocalyptic spiritual revival movement that gave people hope that their way of life would be restored. They would basically dance themselves into a frenzy, and when they collapsed, they would have visions. And the visions would be all about returning to their former way of life, to people and places that they were, that they loved, and land that was sacred to them. But the Indian agents that were managing the reservations were so afraid of this ghost dance ritual that they thought it was going to be the basis for an uprising. And they thought Sitting Bull was actually behind all of it. So in December of 1890, they sent Indian police to arrest Sitting Bull in his cabin on the banks of the Grand River. And a shot was fired. One of the Indians had a gun, and he shot his gun, and immediately the Indian agents shot Sitting Bull and killed him as he was being arrested on that day on the Standing Rock Reservation. And I just think this is such a powerful story because you can just, in my mind's eye, I can just see the people being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and pulled apart and traditions dismantled. I can just see the traditions just being disrespected and people not being able to practice their way of life and starving to death at best in a microcosm of this whole movement of settler colonialism. And so I think it's really important the more and more we can learn about the history of First Nations people in this country, and even before that, the history of world conquest, that is part of our collective history, the more we can understand why Columbus Day is so offensive why this holiday that has been revered for all kinds of reasons really is all about oppression and genocide and conquest. And so I'm going to turn it over to Linda now, but one of the things we've been talking about this week, Jamie has actually been in the process of finding out what it would take to start a petition to invite Milford to honor Indigenous Peoples Day on this day. And I'm hoping that there are people here who would be interested in pursuing that. So maybe by this time next year, we'll be able to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day as a town, as well as as a congregation.
And we wouldn't be the first town to do that, by the way. Durham, New Hampshire now celebrates Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day. There's an ancient Lakota prophecy about a black snake that would slither across the land, desecrating sacred sites and poisoning the water before destroying the earth. So in April of last year, an Indigenous-led movement established camps at Standing Rock in an attempt to cut off the head of the snake through ceremony, through prayer, and absolutely nonviolent civil disobedience. There were no weapons, no alcohol or drugs permitted at the camp. Peaceful water protectors at Standing Rock faced riot gear clad to DAPL security and law enforcement. Law enforcement that used violent force, dogs, mace, rubber bullets, sound cannons, and water cannons in sub-freezing temperatures. One water protector, Vanessa Dundon, was blinded when hit by a tear gas canister. Another, Sophia Wolanski, lost the use of her arm when it was hit by a concussion grenade. The water protectors had been arrested by the hundreds on charges ranging from trespassing to rioting and assault on police officers. Arrestees were subjected to strip searches, held in dog kennel cages. The award-winning journalist Amy Goodman was arrested while filming a documentary at Standing Rock and charged with rioting, a chilling assault on a free press. As Carol mentioned, in November, 500 interfaith clergy shared a day of prayer at Standing Rock, including over 50 UU clergy and our UU president at that time, Peter Morales. And at the end of that day, a copy of that infamous Doctrine of Discovery, that ancient papal justification for Christian explorers to claim any discovered land held by non-Christians. And that doctrine is still embedded in U.S. law. It was ceremonially burned by the visiting clergy. The Bismarck Mandan UU congregation built a yurt at Standing Rock so that there would be a permanent UU presence at the camp. And there was so much rejoicing at the camps last December when the Obama administration stopped the project until a full environmental impact study could be completed with input from the tribes as required by law. But by January, the new administration granted the permits for the pipeline to proceed, ignoring tribal concerns and simply declaring that there was no environmental impact. And the pipes carrying corrosive Bakken crude under Oahe Lake and the Missouri River, which was the drinking water, not only for the reservations, but for the 17 million other people downstream, they didn't need to worry. Pay no attention to the three leaks in the pipeline found during the testing phase before the full force of oil even began flowing. No environmental impact here. The final prayers at Standing Rock were accompanied by winter thunder and lightning in the distance. The thunder beings even supported the water protectors. On February 23rd, the camps that once housed thousands of peaceful protesters from tribes across the continent, from as far as Hawaii and South America, and their black and white allies were razed, and the last 83 holdouts were arrested. So what has become of the hundreds of people arrested at Standing Rock? Justice is far from assured for those who stood on the front lines for clean water, for honoring the sacred, and for rights of indigenous people. The private security contractors hired by DAPL spent months painting the water protectors as criminals, agitators, eco-terrorists. Social media campaigns demonized the protesters, and it worked. A survey conducted by the National Jury Project of the people who would be in the jury pool found that 77% of those in Mandan, North Dakota, and 85% of those in Bismarck had already decided that the water protectors were guilty as charged. Many respondents described the water protectors as criminals, terrorists, and idiots who hopefully would all freeze to death. The state's attorney, Erickson, filed motions in December to disallow defendants from mentioning the following in court: historical treaties between the U.S. government and the Sioux Nation, tribal sovereignty, merits and demerits of the Dakota Access Pipeline, climate change, or sacred sites. Erickson argued that these issues had no relevance to the criminal cases at hand. Right. What possible relevance does the argument that the land is yours by treaty have to whether or not you are trespassing on it? Of the 800-some state cases, about 600 were still unresolved as of this past August. 114 people took a plea deal rather than traveled back to Bismarck to face an unsympathetic jury. Prosecutors, unable to prove the elements of charges that should never have been brought in the first place, have begun dismissing cases by the dozens. But hundreds remain. Of the six cases that were elevated to federal charges, five were recently acquitted and one is still pending. And the bogus riot charge against journalist Amy Goodman was dismissed by the judge. So where does it stand now with Standing Rock? It's not over. In June of this year, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe won their first court victory. The court ruled that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' initial study of the Dakota Access Pipeline's environmental impact was not backed by proper consultation with the tribes and was not extensive enough. A statement, no environmental impact, really doesn't cut it. It was ordered that a new study be conducted. However, they failed to put a stop to the flow of oil while the study is underway. And it may not put a stop to it when the study is completed, we don't know. Both sides have submitted briefs on why the pipeline should or should not be shut down pending the new study. So it's unclear yet whether true justice will come to Standing Rock. But as Robinson Meyer of the Atlantic states, the ruling may establish some important precedents, particularly around environmental justice and treaty rights. Although the months of protest may not change the outcome of DAPL and its threat to Standing Rock drinking water, it may change the outcome of future cases. Oil may be flowing under Lake Oahe but the arc of the moral universe still bends towards justice. Water protectors are winning at least part of the fight against the head of the black snake in the courts. And this movement has inspired so many to continue the fight elsewhere. These are still sacred times. In March, there were teepees rising on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., as tribes from all across Turtle Island gathered to march in support of indigenous peoples' rights and halting environmental destruction. And outside of one teepee was Vanessa Dundon. Remember her? The Navajo woman who was shot in the eye? Since then, she's had 3 surgeries, but still has only 10% of vision in her right eye. It was really hard, she said, at the completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline, because we fought so hard. But we're still here to spread the fire. And she meant that literally. Embers from the sacred fire at Standing Rock are being carried to other pipeline struggles across the country where they light up new struggles. I went to Texas, Dundon said. I went to the Pilgrim Pipeline in New Jersey, and the one in Iowa just started, and I want to go check them out too before I head back to Florida, where I've been to 2 camps there. I'm planning on going to Oklahoma. They're going to light the fire there next week. So even though the 1,200-mile-long Dakota Access Pipeline was not defeated at Standing Rock and now carries thousands of gallons of Bakken crude to the Gulf Coast, a dozen more Standing Rocks have emerged on multiple front lines across the country. Since February, anti-pipeline activists have taken their fight from North Dakota to new camps across the U.S. against pipeline construction and fracking operations in Nebraska, in Iowa, in Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Texas, Florida, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. In New Jersey, Chief Iron Bear is organizing his tribe in a Standing Rock-style action to protest the Pilgrim Pipeline, which poses a risk of widespread safety hazards and pollution and the possibility for a spill that could taint drinking water. The Bears Ears National Monument could be another Standing Rock, both in the potential for desecration of sacred sites and in resistance. After 7 years of organizing, the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, made up of the Hopi, Navajo, Ute, Ouray Ute, Mountain Ute, and Zuni Nations, played a key role in securing the protection of 1.35 million acres surrounding Bears Ears from development and resource extraction just before President Obama left office. The current administration sees it as a last-minute federal land grab and would like to undo it and open up big chunks of it for oil exploration. Bears Ears is the cradle of Native American history. Its pink sands and orange serpentine canyons hold hundreds of thousands of artifacts. Protecting it as a national monument and saving it from desecration was an answer to the prayers of tribal leaders. Terry Tempest Williams of the New York Times writes, "The truth is, the establishment of Bears Ears National Monument was a healing moment of historic importance. A unique agreement was reached between Indian tribes and the U.S. government for a collaborative approach to the management of Bears Ears. It was a clasp of hands across history. It was also about America looking into the deep future together rather than into the narrow exhaust pipe of today. It was about drilling for hope and dignity rather than fossil fuels." To our north, our First Nation neighbors are filing lawsuits against the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Chief Lee Span of Coldwater Nation says, "This is our Standing Rock." And just as natives from Canada came as allies to the Standing Rock water protectors, natives from the U.S. will join them in camps there to attempt to stop a gigantic pipeline all the way to the from across Canada to the Pacific Ocean and the possibility of tainting water supplies all along the way. Chief Arval Looking Horse is a 19th generation keeper of the original sacred white buffalo calf pipe of the Sioux Nation. So I will close with these words from the holy man. Those that know how strong spiritual energy is understand water is the most essential lifeline to survival. It is a source of life that is so powerful that when we offer our energy of prayers, it can change into medicinal healing through united intentions. Water carries the keeper's energy and can change very fast. It can also bring death by not respecting its gift, especially when abused as a resource. It is time we wake up the world to stop abusing and destroying a gift of life before it is too late. Each of us, he says, is put here in this time and place to personally decide the future for humankind. Did you think the Creator would create unnecessary people in a time of such terrible danger? Know that you yourself are essential to this world. Understand both the blessing and the burden of that. You yourself are desperately needed to save the soul of this world. Did you think you were put here for something else?